Good evening. I'm Michael McCusker. Well, what I'd like to read is a potpourri of a few things. And I'd like to start with something I wrote, which I therefore have to give the disclaimer that this is my opinion and perhaps my opinion only in the entire cosmos. It's about Bloody Thursday, the Great Pacific Coast Maritime Strike of 1934. And it was on the 5th of July, 1934, when two strikers were killed by police. And as we celebrated July 4th this year on the 5th, which probably shows the ridiculousness of trying to force our holidays into three-day holidays, I'd like to read about the 5th. Bloody Thursday, the Great Pacific Coast Maritime Strike. 76 years ago this summer, San Francisco was paralyzed by the largest general strike staged by labor unions in this country. It started as a maritime strike in the spring of 1934 when thousands of longshoremen, stevedores as they were often called, walked off the job because they were sick of bad pay and humiliating treatment. They were joined by seamen, teamsters, and other maritime unions, and through unanimous action closed the port of San Francisco for more than 2 months. No ship was loaded or unloaded. No cargo was moved off the docks. In sympathy with the strikers, longshoremen went out on strike in Seattle, Tacoma, Bellingham, Aberdeen, Grays Harbor, Portland, Astoria, Stockton, Los Angeles, San Diego, and all other Pacific Coast ports. The strike was a bloody one. Pickets and police fought bitter pitched battles with guns, gas, and clubs, arrayed against rocks, bricks, and fists. The Industrial Association, a group of shipowners, presidents of stevedoring companies, and other maritime executives, made itself San Francisco's legal authority and continually attempted to open the port with scabs and police, and through hysterical newspaper and radio accounts that labeled the strikers as communists and aliens, which many were. But no matter where they came from or what they believed in, the strikers sought justice and resisted all attempts to outmaneuver them or force them back to work with nothing settled. The battles grew in ferocity until at the beginning of July, they were as savage as a war. On July 3rd, the 70th anniversary of Pickett's charge at Gettysburg, thousands of strikers and police fought all day. The July 4 holiday provided a truce and the day passed peaceably. But in the early morning of Thursday, which is today, July 5th, the fighting resumed where it had left off when police and scabs attempted once more to open the port. Two strikers were shot to death by police revolvers and several hundreds suffered pistol wounds. Hundreds more were hospitalized or dragged into hiding after they were injured by gas and clubs. Mike Quinn, who was a participant of the 1934 maritime strike and a close associate of the strike leader, an Australian stevedore named Harry Bridges, wrote an account of Bloody Thursday in his book, The Big Strike. At 8 a.m. promptly, the police went into action, Quinn wrote. Tear gas bombs were hurled into the picket lines and the police charged with their clubs. Gasping and choking, the strikers were driven back to the alleys off the Embarcadero or retreated up Rincon Hill. Shots rang out as police opened fire with revolvers. Flying bricks and bullets crashed windows. Tear gas sent workers in nearby factory and office buildings swarming into the streets. The whole area was swept by a surf of fighting men. Quinn quoted a newspaper. The hottest battle took place in front of the ILA, International Longshoremen's Association, now the ILWU, International Longshoremen's and Warehousemen's Union, on Stewart Street, where scores were gassed, clubbed, and shot. Police cars literally filled the headquarters with gas from long-range guns, and persons entrenched there poured from the doors. Quinn wrote that workers on the San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge, then under construction, were forced to abandon the job for the day because of stray bullets whistling around their heads. Police charged into the Seaboard Hotel, Quinn continued, where many strikers were quartered, and drove all occupants into the streets, swinging their long riot sticks and cracking skulls right and left. The building was filled with gas and riddled with pistol fire. Stubbornly holding their ground and fighting every inch of the way, the strikers were driven back into the city and off the Embarcadero. The battle swept over into the busy downtown district, endangering crowds of pedestrians. One striker entrenched himself in a parking lot, devised a crude slingshot from an old inner tube, and began bombarding Chief of Police William J. Quinn's, no relation to Mike Quinn, car with bricks. It took a barrage of tear gas and pistol fire to dislodge him. A badly wounded man lying on the pavement cursed the police and refused to allow them to remove him. Later, he was taken to a hospital in a private car. Scores of men littered the sidewalks, either lying silently or crawling away painfully on their hands and knees. A woman alighting from a streetcar at the ferry building screamed and collapsed when a bullet struck her in the temple. A man rushed to her assistance, was struck by another bullet, and crumpled to the street beside her. A Chronicle reporter described, "Women who had been shopping in downtown stores arrived at the Loop to step into an inferno. With screaming children clinging to them, they disembarked from the cars to find themselves in clouds of smarting tear gas. Guns cracked. Men fell screaming as they went down. Police clubs cracked against skulls. Smothered and blinded by gas, the women and children staggered about helplessly. Policemen grabbed them as fast as possible and sent them to a hospital, where they were horrified by the sight of men dripping with blood, moaning from bullet wounds and injuries. People in surrounding buildings were driven out by gas, and many were winged by stray shots as they fled." And I am now continuing Quinn. "At the height of the battle, a delegation from the strike committee, headed by Harry Bridges, called on Mayor Angelo J. Rossi to protest. The mayor simply repeated what acting California Governor Frank Merriam's had said earlier, 'You refuse to arbitrate, now take the consequences.' Hospitals were put on a wartime basis to accommodate the wounded. At the morgue, covered over by white sheets, were two cold, quiet bodies, Howard Sperry and Nicholas Bourdois, or Bourdois, however his name was pronounced. The striking unions had men detailed to the hospitals to see that wounded pickets received adequate attention when brought in from the battlefield. These men reported later that injured strikers were threatened and intimidated by police when they stated that their club and gunshot wounds were caused by officers. At the close of the day, Acting Governor Merriam ordered the National Guard onto the waterfront. 2,000 troops marched into the area equipped with rapid-fire guns, machine guns, gas equipment, and bayoneted rifles. By the time they arrived, the fighting had ceased and the pickets had been driven from the Embarcadero. The guardsmen posted themselves at intervals down the whole length of the waterfront and mounted machine guns on the roofs of piers. Troops marched in wearing steel helmets and full service equipment. They set up camp inside the long covered docks, established field kitchens, and remained there under wartime conditions. Divisions were brought in from Santa Rosa, Napa, Petaluma, Gilroy, and other outlying towns. Rumors were abundant to the effect that certain units had refused service, but strict censorship was maintained and definite confirmations were lacking. All day long, newspapers uptown had been pouring out extra after extra, delivering veritable hourly reports from the line of battle. Wailing sirens careening up and down Market Street aroused speculation and alarm among the public. The word blood, blood, blood recurred every three or four lines in every news story. So much blood had been seen that it obsessed the minds of news writers, and the word was repeated again and again, almost involuntarily, as they typed their copy. Reporters had been in the thick of the fighting all day long. Many had bruised limbs and minor injuries to help them remember. These hurts soon healed and passed away, but an experience, a reality, was impressed in their minds that would never wear away and would affect their ideas, their decisions, and their loyalties for the rest of their lives. The strikers named the day Bloody Thursday." And that was from Michael Quinn's book, The Big Strike. On Monday, July 9th, 1934, a funeral march was held for Howard Sperry and Nicholas Bourdois, or Bourdois. 40,000 men, women, and children marched in silence, 8 and 10 abreast the length of Market Street, behind trucks that carried the 2 coffins and flowers. A union band played a funeral march by Beethoven. A newspaper described the procession as a river of men flowing up Market Street like cooling lava, solemn strains of dirges and hymns, uncountable thousands of spectators lining the streets with uncovered heads, overhead a brilliant sun in a cloudless sky. Another newspaper said that the 2 dead strikers in life wouldn't have commanded a second glance on the streets of San Francisco, but in death they were borne the length of Market Street in a stupendous and reverent procession that astounded the city. A week later, a general strike was declared in San Francisco, and the city was effectively shut down for 3 days. For all practical purposes, Mike Quinn wrote, not a wheel moved or a lever budged. The official reaction was hysteria. The general strike was confused with revolution. Rumors in newspapers claimed that a communist army was marching on the city from the north. Northwesterners were thought to be communists and radicals because of strong IWW activity the preceding decade. That's Oregon and Washington. 500 extra policemen were hired and thousands more National Guardsmen were sent to San Francisco from all over California. Police red squads raided strikers' homes and union offices. Vigilantes attacked and beat striking workers that they accused of being communists. The maritime strike ended in late July 1934, and the port of San Francisco was reopened. The maritime unions were awarded recognition. Contracts were signed, and demands were met or promised to be met through arbitration, among them the crucial issue of hiring halls to be controlled by the unions and a ban on blacklisting strikers from employment. Longshore pay was raised and dockside hours shortened. But all this did not bring peace to the waterfront, Mike Quinn wrote several years later. Instead, there ensued a period of industrial guerrilla warfare, which persisted for more than 2 years, ultimately resulting in the whole Pacific Coast maritime strike breaking out again in greater force than ever, the Great Maritime Strike of 1936. The Great Pacific Coast Maritime Strike of 1934 was the harbinger of future labor battles in steel, auto, rubber, and other smokestack industries in the United States. It heralded the vast organizing drives that gave birth to the CIO, the Congress of Industrial Organizations, which later became affiliated with the American Federation of Labor to become the AFL-CIO. And it set an example of militant solidarity that proved beneficial to other unions in the great labor struggles of the 1930s. The 1934 strike is memorable because, above all, it demonstrated the power latent in the rank and file, Harry Bridges said a few years later. The rank and file not only manned the picket lines and did the sacrificing, as it must in every strike, but it also made the big decisions and determined the strategy. The rank and file would not be bulldozed or buffaloed, browbeaten or divided, and therefore it couldn't be licked. Once it knew the score, the rank and file could not be misled by any phony labor leader or panicked by any barrage of newspaper propaganda. Bridges also said that, ultimately, the power of any union that serves as an instrumentality of the workers rests on the courage and conviction in its ranks. That is the one fundamental truth that has not altered since 1934, nor will it alter in times to come. We have had strikes on the waterfront since 1934, Bridges said, but never again have the bosses dared to shoot our men down in cold blood. For many years after Bloody Thursday, each July 5th was commemorated by maritime workers who took unauthorized days off to march once again by the thousands up Market Street in honor of the 2 dead strikers. One ship owner bitterly complained that, on every July 5th, there is a complete cessation of work up and down the whole Pacific coast because of a holiday declared by the unions for the purpose of commemorating a day of violence and bloodshed. No one authorizes the July 5th holiday excepting a 100% of accord of the entire maritime profession, Mike Quinn wrote in The Big Strike, which was first published in 1949, 13 years after he wrote it and 2 years after his death at 41. Therefore, it is regarded as a completely unauthorized stoppage of work and an illegal act. The maritime unions have nothing by which to defend this annual disregard for authority other than an old, almost forgotten phrase in the yellowed documents of the Revolution of 1776, which ends, "by the consent of the governed." And that was Mike Quinn. And of course, now it has been 76 years since Bloody Thursday. And to keep on with the commerce of things, I'd like to read something that I have read before, and I'm sure some of you have listened to or heard before. I call it Summer Gold Rush, and my disclaimer is still extant. The silly season is in full avarice. Cash registers from coast to coast and amusement parks in between are playing America's song. Our Oregon and Washington beach towns are emporiums of prosperity, their streets and sands swarming with an annual infestation of sun and fun-hungry protoplasm. Everybody wants a cut of the tourist buck. Tourism attempts to fill the void left by depleted natural resources whose exploitation built and sustained the local coastal culture until the forests were cut down and the great fish runs decimated by the impetuous greed of white settlers and their descendants. A magnificent land that had thrived for millennia was ravaged in a century. Now, sultans of sun replace loggers and fisher people. They build shopping centers and malls, condominiums, bigger and glitzier motels, restaurants and bars that remove the remaining trees and block ocean views. Cannon Beach, which in an earlier era resisted opportunities to be a second Carmel, has acquiesced and booms like a gold strike town. Seaside mixed its sand with water and remade its graceful downtown into a cement mall. Astoria hustles its failed history to draw tourists from the beach towns. Complaints about tourism are usually whines about discourtesies, inconveniences, and crowds of noisy, fussy, impatient strangers. But sometimes criticisms are registered about the sort of environment that is being imposed upon a previously neglected string of coastal towns and the ambivalence of residents between tourist revenues and environmental quality. The current practices of coastal entrepreneurs are a local symptom of a national malady, that money is all that counts, and anything in the way of making a buck deserves to be deep-sixed. Tourism has a habit of destroying what it seeks, and amidst the commercial glitter and singing cash registers, the real gold is slipping out of our hands. Connie Rose Anderson, who used to live in Cannon Beach and in 1980 wrote an article for the North Coast Times-Eagle, A Short History of Seaside, perceived clearly the changes tourism has wrought. And this is Connie Rose. Somewhere behind the pavement, the aluminum-framed, junk-filled windows, the traffic, the pinball machines, and snow cone litter lurks the ghost of a pretty little beach town. A town that welcomed progress as a friend, resisted not at all, and in the short span of a human's lifetime, died under its feet with little more than a whimper. Seaside, whatever it is today, is not a pretty little town, either in physical appearance or character. The Oregon coast wears on its shores a string of such pretty little towns, Cannon Beach, Manzanita, Nehalem, all today facing the same forces and models of thinking which have transformed so many of Oregon's coastal gems into a string of tasteless clunkers. Like Godzilla in a greenhouse, the tourist industry is a powerful force plowing through the small town's natural environment, leaving in its wake a trail of highway architecture, parking lots, condominiums, mobile home courts, souvenir junk outlets, and the threats of legalized gambling. And the pretty little town loses more than just its physical beauty to the impersonal wasteland of the commercially controlled tourist trap. It loses its small-town energy and character, which are the truest sources of its beauty and grace, and which loss no cosmetic compromise by developers can remedy or replace. And that was Connie Rose Anderson and me. Now I'd like to read something by my friend Arthur Honeyman. I was just thinking of him. I do a great deal of the time. is spastic power and irrational feeling. They no longer throw people like me over a cliff. I should probably find that example of historical progression comforting, but I think it is threatening instead. I am a spastic. I was born with cerebral palsy. I am a freak. My body shakes like four winds tearing at it from all points of the compass. My speech is tortured, almost to being incomprehensible. I drool and vomit almost uncontrollably. I cannot even write without laboriously dictating to someone. I also cannot eat unless someone feeds me. To go to the bathroom, someone has to take me, put me on the toilet, and wait until I'm finished. I have to be undressed for bed and dressed the next day for work and school. I am and have to be cared for like a six-month-old baby. But my mind is free. I am a scholar, a poet, and teacher. I have campaigned twice for the Oregon State Legislature, and I have traveled alone or accompanied by friends throughout the United States. I am a freak and sometimes an embarrassment to others, but not to myself. Living within this shaking body, however fettered it may seem, is to me the most natural way of living because it is the only life I have known. I do not exist because of society's benevolence. I am not a charity case dependent upon a historical moment of benevolent distraction by the larger society, and I am not alone. Within the greater Portland area, there are some 70,000 persons officially classified as physically handicapped. These people are the chronic cripples such as myself, born with cerebral palsy or other malfunctioning or missing parts. They are aged, whose once strong mobile bodies have withered and decayed to an almost functional paralysis. They are the deaf and blind. They are the victims of accidents and wars, many especially from the profusion of landmines and booby traps used in the wars of Southeast Asia and the Middle East, which have rendered an unbearable proportion of young men and women without arms or legs, not to mention the great number who've lost their sexual organs. These are the physically handicapped. There are many thousands of us, but somehow we remain functionally and politically invisible. Let's face it, the problem of cripples is not a priority. It's not even a priority to cripples themselves. Cripples are doing all right these days. They're not being thrown off cliffs. My analysis of the political situation of cripples in Portland and in all major cities starts with the notion that people do not want to talk about it, nor want to do anything about it. And when they do something, they want to do it quickly to get it over with rather than follow it up with new ideas and new forms of action. Because mobility and easy access to most parts of the city is virtually impossible, urban life for the physically handicapped is almost a nightmare. More than just physically forbidding, it is psychologically debilitating. The term physically handicapped is itself a psychological handicap. It implies that we are just a medical problem with which the larger society has to contend. It makes us feel as if we are not responsible for ourselves, but are totally dependent for our survival. Yet the fact that there are so many thousands of us in just this metropolitan area alone could be of considerable significance. Together, we could have forcible impact on decisions, or the lack of them, that determine our lives. We are potentially visible. Cripples themselves are reluctant to act because they do not realize what positive things action can do. They feel only the negative aspects. They feel they will lose money from the Division of Vocational Rehabilitation or financial and moral support from charitable organizations and friends. Cripples have been taught from early childhood to be grateful for what they have and to smile bravely in spite of the hardships, or they are indeed surviving in a benevolent society. Admittedly, cripples have never had it so good, and for me personally, Portland has proved to be a virtual paradise. Where else could a spastic run for political office, initiate a city task force to study the problems of the physically handicapped, take active part in the anti-war movement, or demand to see the mayor on his own terms? What other city has not only raised the issue, but given its facilities for cripples to publish their own questions and demands? I have established a reputation in Portland that I feel I could not establish anywhere else in the world, but it is not enough to learn to accept my condition as a cripple in society, nor is it enough to learn to teach society to accept me. Given the expectations and dependencies with which I was raised, it takes a lot of gall to write something like this, which does not show a humble and grateful cripple. As far as I know, I am the only one who writes about cripples from a political viewpoint. It has been my experience that even so-called political radicals, the champions of the underdog, do not write about cripples. Political liberals write about what is being done for cripples, but not about what is not being done. Cripples not only do not write, but they don't think I should write. The boat should not be rocked, especially by a spastic. Part of the problem is that some cripples go inside themselves to find inner religious sources of comfort, thereby ignoring the terrible realities and problems they confront. Having found that solution, they are only perpetuating the problems they so greatly fear. I am called a cynic because I challenge the spiritual call in order to find and take political action. A spiritualist does not disturb the existing order of things. A spiritualist accepts. Acceptance is what makes people happy. I am more interested in survival. A woman told me years ago that I would be better off dead. The statement itself almost scared me to death, but it taught me a valuable lesson. From then on, survival has been my primary interest. Survival depends upon a multitude of factors. Foremost among them is the realization that cripples like myself cannot allow our survival to be wholly dependent upon the good graces of society. We must understand that we are a social and political force and have the power to determine our own lives. We must also make society realize that we are citizens also, that we have as much a vested interest as anyone in the political processes that determine the planning of our cities and the forms of our government. If society continues to see us with blind eyes, if society continues to regard us as a problem instead of as an integral part of that society, then I predict that politically the cripple has no hope for survival, especially when it comes to the question of emergency life or death conditions, which could occur in times of political chaos or intensified fear. Under such conditions, cripples will be more than a social inconvenience. They will be an expendable danger to society and mercifully killed again. And that was by Arthur Honeyman. He wrote that in 1974. He died almost 2 years ago on December 8th, 2008. And he was 68. He would have been 70 this last May 10th, 2 months and, well, almost 2 days short of 2 months ago. Of all the people I've known, both in war and peace, that are dead, including most of my family, Arthur is really the only one I just cannot abide being dead. He just should not have left this planet so soon. This has been Michael McCusker. Good evening.